Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. Or you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm honored to have as my guest David Markson. The occasion is the last novel, which has been published by Shoemaker and Horde. They are now known as Counterpoint, and they have also republished David Markson's first novel, The Ballad of Dingus McGee, as well as his prior entertainments, as Graham Greene used to say, Epitaph for a Tramp and Epitaph for a Deadbeat. They're published in the same volume. They're the Harry Fannin detective novels. Also published by Shoemaker and Horde, Vanishing Point, This Is Not a Novel, by Donkey Archive, Reader's Block, and Wittgenstein's Mistress. This is going in reverse order. Donkey also publishes Springer's Progress and David Markson's collected poems. They have done Going Down, his unconventional novel, is published by Counterpoint, which was then known as Shoemaker and Horde. An unconventional history for an unconventional writer. Now, you know, since I started the show 19 years ago, I get frequent calls from listeners asking me to talk to particular writers. And I have to tell you that you, David Markson, are the most frequent request that I've had. And I've been planning for several years to come to New York City to talk to David Markson, and here I am. The new novel, the last novel, is the most recent in a series of novels. They are not only each to be read separately, they are, when put together, interconnected in certain ways. Anyone who is a reader, and most of the listeners to this program are, will love the kind of novels these are. Now, could you describe what the books, or at least most recently, describe as your personal genre?
First of all, I wonder who those people are who have phoned you. I don't have that many friends. Strangers. I think what you mean is the structure, the approach, the method in these books. And what I do is essentially leave out most of the baggage of the usual novel. Plot, character, dramatic incidents, dramatic scenes, which sounds as if there's nothing much left. Some people probably think there is nothing much left. But these books are loaded with incidental odds and ends, intellectual snippets, whatever you might call them, about literary people, about artists, about composers, about even sometimes sports figures. But quotations, sometimes attributed, sometimes not. However, they all do have, they tie together with certain themes. What they are basically conveying is the nature of the artistic life. Most frequently, it's despairs and defeats, or sometimes even rotten reviews, and sometimes even from their peers who should be kinder. But in each of the books, there is also one central figure. He is called different things. He's called reader in reader's block. He's called writer, author, and most recently novelist, not the novelist, novelist. And bits and pieces about him are threaded through the book. Reader's block is a little different. He takes up about 20% of the book, and much more is said about him, his situation, and so on. In the other three, there's nothing but the bare bones. But when Michael refers to my personal genre, as I have it called in the last of the books, I do have one aim in mind with this experiment, and no matter how much I'm leaving out of that baggage, as we've called it, I want the reader to care, to follow my character, and to be moved at the end. I say in one of them, you know, that whoever he is, or author, is just sick and tired of writing plots and making up, inventing stories. And I quote a number of people. I begin to forget who. I think Ivy Compton Burnett at one point saying, why does a novel need scenery and so on? And I leave that out.
One of the things you also say is that part of the experiment is to keep the reader reading. And in fact, I want to describe my reading experience of it, because not only do I find these books heartbreaking and beautiful, there's something very unusual. What happens is I'll intend to read another 10 pages, but then the structure of it's a kind of web, and there'll be a new subject, like a leitmotif, introduced, and no, I'll read another 10 paragraphs.
Thank you.
And
thank
then
you.
There'll be a repetition. And I'll say, oh, no, I can't stop just now. So I almost inevitably find myself reading 50 pages more than the number
of books
pages
are
I intended.
They're only, none of these four are more than 200 pages, are they?
Yes. And what's exciting to me is that sense of the author having left so much of the traditional readability of a novel, the continuity out, but left behind, I hate to say this because it suggests something non-nutritive, but I eat them up like popcorn. I find myself, it's irresistible.
But you know, I'll tell you something, it's difficult. I dig out these bits and pieces, whatever we call them, of intellectual trivia, but they're hard to come by. And I go to a certain bookstore here in New York, the Strand, frequently. I've been going there all my adult life. And a few of the managers or other people suddenly will hand me a book they think I can use. And sometimes they are collections of anecdotes or quotes. And I'll go through the entire collection and a book of 500 pages. Or maybe once in a while I'll find something I've already used, but I'll find one or two things, and one or two of these people have looked at me in astonishment, and one of them said, "Boy, you certainly only take the creme de la creme," and I guess that's it. I must be gifted with an eye or an ear to spot the right quote and the right. In fact, when I make these, I make notes of these things on index cards. And then I rewrite the index cards, except for direct quotes. But I would say, as they're piling up one behind the other, I use the tops of shoebox tops. But every third one, every second one that I have managed to let myself select, every second one of those has a question mark down in the corner. Is this really good? Do I really want it? So that when I look and let's say I'm partway through and I've got, there are about 2,000 of these items in each of the books, and Maybe I've got 1,000, but I look and I say, no, it's probably only 400, even though I've chosen those with care. And I'll tell you something, it's getting harder to find them. You know, I picked up a book the other day, a popular history of ancient Greek literature, I began to browse, and everything, I had used everything. It comes through Euripides. There are not that many items, not that many anecdotes. Sophocles, I've used them all. Aeschylus, I've used them all. You know, I know that he fought at Marathon and fought in Salamis and this and that. I'm running out of famous people to talk about.
Well, you see, I think also after the culling process has been initiated, some of these data are transformed into characteristic sentence shapes. There are certain eccentricities of syntax. Sometimes it will name a city, comma, and it will tell us who died there, as if it's an entry in a gazetteer. There are within these books certain, what would you call them, mini-forms or particularized, one, if it were poetry, one might say, inventions of certain kinds of stanzas that recur and become a group. So all of this material is, pardon the expression, processed into Marxian speak.
Oh, yeah, and I don't know where it came from. It was just revision, and finally I've fall into patterns that I like. In fact, an interesting thing happened. Someone wanted to interview me for some on paper, and every question he gave me was so full of praise. Yeah, you do this and that and the other thing so wonderfully. How do you do it? So I answered him. I wasn't really thinking in these terms, but when he got the answers, he said, "I don't think I can use this. It's too laudatory. You're praising yourself too much." I just let it drop. I said, "All right, forget the whole thing." But no, I don't know. How do you describe the is it the magic of prose or poetry? How do we know why Hopkins writes the way he writes and Dylan Thomas writes the way he writes? And some of these things, once I fell into certain patterns, let's say June 17th, 1927, comma, so-and-so died on, well, then I will use it all the way through the book. Or leukemia, so-and-so died of. But I don't know where it came from originally. I really don't. I am spending $1 million on those little 3x5 index cards. I'll write something down, a little anecdote. I'm reading a book, and I'll abridge an anecdote that took 2-3 pages. I'll abridge it to 30 words. Then I rewrite it, and that index card gets tossed into the basket or on the floor and another one. And suddenly there'll be 8 torn up index cards for the one that I'm saving, which, of course, will probably have the question mark next to it. But also I write REW, encircle it, meaning rewrite, meaning I'm not satisfied. And I'm so pleased when once in a while I realize I've put a card in, maybe it's the 6th or 7th or 8th version, but and I don't put rewrite. But once I get around to typing it, note the word, I don't have a computer, to typing the, putting it on paper instead of the cards, then, of course, it'll all be rewritten yet again, you know. And I do things to balance them out, too. If I have a certain sentence structure here, opposite it, I may want the same kind of thing again. And the same way that items about people or about certain themes will repeat. I'll say something on page 47 and 7 pages later maybe pick up on it again and then 30 pages a variant on it. So I guess in a way, I you know, that might explain something about readership. The books make demands that people aren't even perhaps willing to admit they're happy to accede to, that they want to pay attention this way. And that's nice. That means they are readers, real readers.
I'm speaking with David Markson. You're listening to Bookworm, and I'm Michael Silverblatt. Bookworm comes from the studios of KCRW. David Markson is the author, most recently, of the last novel published by Shoemaker and Horde. They are now known as Counterpoint. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with David Markson about his book, The Last Novel. It's very interesting to me. As an epigraph to the second of these books, this is not a novel, there's an epigraph from Swift who says, "I am now trying an experiment very frequent among modern authors, which is to write upon nothing." Now, I didn't know the Swift quote, and I thought it was Flaubert, principally, who announced that Madame Bovary is a book about nothing. But I'm curious. These books do not seem to me to be books about nothing.
Well, I meant in my use of it, I came upon it. I don't remember where, just browsing. But I meant it in the sense that it's about nothing if you compare it to the ordinary novel, the traditional novel, the commercial novel. What's the novel about? Oh, it's about a breaking up marriage, or it's about a domestic tragedy or something. And these books are not about that. But, of course, they're about everything, on the other hand. Basically, lately, they've been about death, it seems to me. But
well, it's helpful because, to some extent, you know, when you read a book that's strange and new, you think about it in different ways. And all of these little paragraphs began to seem to me like a necropolis, as if the book were a cemetery. And these were tombstones laid out
I love that.
In
Thank
order
you.
Upon the page, carefully, yeah. Stately, you know, just stretching out as far as the eye can see, a cavalcade of deaths, of monuments.
Oh, boy, now you're giving me a title for my next book. I'll call it Cemetery. But that's interesting. It's a way of thinking about it. But I don't do those things. Some of the descriptive phrases that I've mentioned that I put in, I felt were necessary because the books were just offbeat enough that people might need a crutch or two. But I don't sit and abstract these things in my mind and say, what actually am I doing? It's created from a different angle. I say, does this work? Does this sound right? Does this suggest what I'm trying to suggest?
But if one took the old-fashioned notion that a novelist creates a picture of our times, I began to think that these novels do want to tell us something about the times we live in. For instance, a certain number of them deal with the Holocaust and anti-Semitism. A certain percentage of them deal with the fates of neglected women writers and painters and singers. There's almost in the commentary on Artemisia, the sense of let's pay attention, let's redress certain accounts. There's a certain percentage of writers attacking one another. In other words, the subject is the viciousness of the profession itself, and then of critics attacking writers. I sense that these, one could call them themes, leitmotifs, are, what to say, organized according to novelists' sense of the importance of these subjects, none of them as paramount as the subject of death and dying.
Well, yes, I do deal with those same themes, but it's interesting you say about the modern, it talks about the modern world, yet there are quotations, anecdotes, references in here to the Greek dramatists, to even occasionally Hindu or Oriental works of art. And so it's essentially timeless. I mean, at the end of the book you have in your hand, at the end of This Is Not a Novel, very near the end, I refer to Bhatrahari, Indian, long forgotten, I mean, by us, poet, and he's lamenting the poverty of poets, writing in Sanskrit, and yet nothing has changed, you know. Look, go back to ancient Greece and Aristophanes mocking the other writer, playfully generally, mocking Euripides constantly. This is 2,500 years ago, and yet it could be today, and a lot of that is spurious too. I mean, Byron spent his life condemning Shakespeare and yet quoting him all the time. He knew him better than most people did.
And then sometimes a phrasing will be so beautiful that it will appear and then recur in the end of the last novel. A sentence from the Buddha, "I am weary, Ananda, and wish to lie down."
That was almost, those were, I believe, his dying words or his final words. And I'm pretty sure I've used that in more than one book. I try not to repeat anecdotes and whatnot, but a few quotes I do repeat. And it seemed appropriate and I liked it. And also there's the factor that I'm hoping one day, I don't imagine I'll still be here, but these four books, perhaps one more, these four books will be printed in one volume. And then, both things. I don't want people to be stumbling over the same story, but I don't mind, and I will be happy to have them come upon a certain few quotes repeated from book to book.
A final question. Always and ultimately, the thing that moves me most in these books is of a writer who has, whatever the content of these intellectual fragments, some of them are funny, some of them are melodramatic, some of them are quite self-piteous. Always the tone is kind of stoic, distanced, and bracing. And the clear-eyed contemplation of approaching death seems to be what's constantly moving and heartbreaking in these books, because so few of us are capable of passing a cold eye over these materials.
I don't have any idea what to say. It's very difficult, you know, to hear nice things said about your work and answer. No, I've fallen into a voice, and I guess now, by now, I know it. I know when I have it and when I don't, and frequently lately writing notes, and I'll write one six or seven times, and when I put that R-E-W, meaning rewrite in the corner, I know, gee, I haven't caught this, but later on, when I'm doing a number of them, one after the other in revision, it'll come. I'll hear myself again, hear the what I want to hear, and find how to put it there. But that's not very helpful. I'm not saying anything much. But it's
death.
Listen, you get to be a certain age. What else is there? You should hear the phone conversations I have with my few remaining writer friends. I don't want to mention their name, but a very well-known writer a few weeks ago on the phone. And I said to him, after we've both been discussing one ailment or another, I said, I'm never going to call you again if we're going to just talk the same way. And he said, did I call you or did you call me? I was going to say the same thing, something like that. One friend, my phone rang, someone who didn't have to identify his voice. And I picked up and the voice just said, I'm taking attendance. And it took me a minute to catch on, but I yelled, here, I'm still alive, in other words. So death, yes. I quote Hemingway somewhere. Doesn't he say, all stories, if carried long enough, carried forward far enough, they end in death. They have to. What more can be said?
I've been speaking with David Markson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm. David Markson's most recent novel is The Last Novel. Thank you for joining me, David.
Michael, it's been my pleasure, and I thank you very much.
My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to recording engineer Leszek Wojcik at the Carnegie Hall Studios in New York City. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
Books can be funny, too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme.
Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time. To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.